How did I get designated as the parent who always cleans up the puke? That's what I want to know.
Because you're just the only one who can handle it.
I don't
do puke.
Obviously, because I, by default, have had to for...
And you don't do blood.
That's true.
I do the blood, you do the puke.
Yep.
So, it works.
Yeah. Anyways, right before we came up here, I had to do my fatherly duty and clean up after one of our children.
This was a disgusting way to start a podcast.
Yeah. But we have a lot of parents out there who understand.
That's true.
And it's when you live overseas too, it's like it's all the time.
Yeah, between there's always living, something.
Between living overseas and having five kids.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, the environment, there's a lot of sickness that you pick up because you're not used to this environment. And
yeah,
it's just a lot of.
I want to know if other parents have this same kind of division of duties that we do. Is one always the puke cleaner upper?
Yeah.
Or always the blood bandager?
Yeah. I mean, I can do small cuts, but if it's significant amount of blood or something, then no, it's not me.
I wonder if other people do this. Yeah.
I guess we should note that everybody is going to be fine. It's just a little childhood thing.
Yeah. Nothing serious.
Nobody's dying. No, nothing horrible.
Just one of those things.
Yep. So, you know, beyond that, our life right now, what's going on?
Well, we are doing a lot of things to prepare for our upcoming furlough.
Yeah.
I've got lots of checklists and I am slowly making progress on them.
Yeah. And I've helped too. I cleaned out two junk drawers the other day that you thought were humanly impossible
organize. All the thousands of micro decisions involved in cleaning out a junk drawer, it just completely paralyzes me. And I am super thankful that you did those and
Don't
not
worry.
Me.
I got it. I got the puke. I got the junk drawers.
Got all the things that I can't handle. I've been booking campsites for a trip out west to visit some supporting churches in September and October. And I don't know if you know this, but booking campsites in the most popular national parks is insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to be on their website at exactly the moment they open, exactly 6 months before you want to stay there. And we had four devices some days, both of our laptops and our phones, ready to go. The second it clicked over, at our time, it's 4 o'clock.
I was literally counting down 10, 9, 8.
And we hit all four buttons at the exact same time. And some days we still didn't get a site.
Yeah.
But a couple of days we did.
We got one out of the four.
Yeah. It's just, it's unreal how insane it is to try to get a campsite.
And we have a dog looking at us through the window.
Poe heard our voices and he's
Poe the guard dog heard us and was, now he's big enough. He just got up on his hind legs and was looking at us through the window. Wow. Yeah, campsites. And
anyway, that's been crazy and pretty stressful for several days.
And we're getting ready to order 10,000 prayer cards.
10,000.
Yeah, I did the math and that's about what we need
Holy
to order.
Holy smokes. Yeah. I hope we have that many people praying for us after all this.
Well, that's the point. So, you know, go big so that you have lots of prayers out there.
Yeah.
For the ministry. So, 10,000 based on the number of churches we're visiting and how many people go to each church and then just extra for other events and stuff. So, but it is pretty cool to think that if we distribute 10,000, there's 10,000 people who hopefully are praying for us.
And yeah, even that's amazing.
Even if half of them are praying regularly for us. That's 5,000 people. That's pretty incredible.
That is. The girls are feeling the crunch of the end of our time before furlough too. They're trying to get caught up on some of their schoolwork that they've gotten a little behind on. You know, the beauty of homeschooling is that you can go at your own pace, but one of the possible pitfalls of homeschooling is that you get a little behind.
Your pace is too slow. So
yeah, so they're trying to get caught up on and they're getting excited and nervous about seeing their friends and family and all of that back in the US.
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking for us, but middle school girls going back into, you know, big youth group and friend issues and
middle school is brutal.
Middle school is the worst time of anyone's life.
Yeah. And it's a terrible time to go back to the U.S.
So if you're listening and you are part of the youth group or something, then, you know, just keep in mind that it's going to be tough on them.
Yeah. If you've got kids around their age, please encourage them to include our kids and be patient with them when they're clueless about, I don't know, inside jokes, cultural norms, who knows what all they've missed out on.
Yeah. Yep.
These last 4 years. Be patient with their hand-me-down clothes and
So by the time this releases, we'll have been doing clinics for a couple of weeks. And right now we're just getting geared up for it and going to start on Monday, going out to different villages, remote areas with medical care and with the gospel. And we just finished up the final term of the year of the academic year for Shepherd's Academy. So all the guys were here and they left last week. And so today's podcast is going to focus on something that I can't believe we've never done a podcast about, which is pastor training.
Which is the main thing that you do here.
I mean, we've talked about it in bits and pieces, but we've never done a podcast completely devoted to pastor training. So I thought, well, it's about time.
Yeah.
And I hope that we do this in a way that people who aren't pastors or aren't, you know, theology nerds will enjoy it and at least, you know, have a better idea of what we do. So we'll see if we can accomplish that. I'm Josh.
And I'm Stacey Lee. We're missionaries in Malawi with Gospel Life Global Missions.
And this is the Gospel Life Podcast, where we talk about missions, Malawi, and more.
So before we start talking about what you actually do, I'm curious to know, what's your goal with pastor training?
Yeah, so, you know, when you are setting out to teach, you want to know, like, what is the end product of this? What are we going to produce? And I think good teachers are thinking not just in terms of, you know, passing this exam or whatever. And that's part of the reason why we homeschool and we do the method of homeschooling that we do, classical education, because it's focused not just on, you know, passing classes, but forming a person out of the process. Like, you want to have a well-rounded person out of this education. And the same thing is true in pastor training. So what kind of pastors are we wanting to produce? What kind of people do we want to form through this teaching and training? That then goes back and determines, like, what you're doing and how you're doing it. So obviously we want to develop and disciple, because pastor training is just a form of discipleship, right? We want to disciple godly pastors. And what is a godly pastor? I mean, you you've been in church most of your life. What do you think of when you think of a godly pastor?
I think of a man who is above reproach in his personal life.
Yeah. So, you know, that's part of the qualification from 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1.
Right.
Is you have to have the right character to even be qualified to being a pastor. But then what else? I'm just curious what comes to your mind.
I think of someone who's able to teach the word well.
Yeah. So that goes along with first spiritual gifting, to have the talent and the ability to mm-hmm. teach. But then you have to develop that gift both through learning the skills of preaching and teaching and also learning the Bible and theology itself.
Yeah.
So that you know how to take this book and explain it in a way that will affect people's lives.
Yeah.
What else do pastors do?
I think that he should be humble and a servant.
Yeah.
Of his people. You know, just really there to serve and not to be the big shot or or anything like that.
Yeah. Develop servant attitude, servant leadership, trust in God instead of just pushing all the time to accomplish their goals, but trusting that God is going to do the work, I think, is involved in that. Obviously, wise counsel is an important part of being a pastor. So you have people getting married, you're doing funerals, you have people going through crises in their life, and you have to come in with godly wisdom into those situations.
Yeah, which also involves knowing the word really well.
Yeah, yeah. And not just knowing, okay, who wrote the book of Deuteronomy, but also like knowing it in a personal way that you have been helped by the word in this way. So now you can apply it to someone else's life. You kind of, sometimes we talk about, you know, people coming at inappropriate times with scriptures to people's lives. Like, you know, there's just been a horrible car accident and somebody just kind of surface level quotes Romans 8:28, all things work together for good, you know, which is fine.
Which I think true
is true, and it's fine to bring that scripture in an appropriate way. But a lot of times what can happen is somebody uses it in a very, I mean, maybe the word's glib. Is that, is that the right word?
Yeah.
Just kind of, you know, not sensitive to what's going on. So the way you counter that is by knowing the word in a personal way through the trials and temptations and difficulties of your own life, so that you can then apply it with greater wisdom and sensitivity to others' lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, you know, I think we're kind of painting this picture of a godly pastor is someone who has good character, who has a strong personal relationship with the Lord himself, and who therefore is able to preach and counsel and shepherd the church in a way that takes biblical and theological truth and applies it with wisdom. And, you know, you think of all of that and wow, what a task it is to teach pastors and train pastors. I mean, it is overwhelming if that is truly your goal to help develop. And it's not, you know, it's not a factory. Like, you can't just move people through the process. Okay, here's the character, you know, component, and let's attach this part and let's attach this part. And at the end of the day, have what you're looking for. You're dealing with people, but you know, that's the goal. That's the desire and what we hope to see at the end of the day.
Yeah. So how do you do that?
Well, if you look at, especially missions organizations, people are interested in doing this not just in a North American or European context, but around the world. Mm-hmm. And especially when you think about training pastors who are coming from rural village settings, like our pastors come from, who have minimum education period, very minimal reading levels, you know, that is, that's the challenge that's before us. And so it's going to look very different, or at least it should look very different from going to a seminary class in Louisville or Wake Forest or Fort Worth, you know.
Right.
You can't take that North American model and really use it here in the same way. There are elements that obviously are going to stay the same no matter where you're teaching, but and that's why if you look at people who are doing this, you know, some people have opted for the online method. So there's some organizations that focus on putting online classes and materials for pastors around the world. Some people have focused on doing modular training through mission trips. So people from the US are constantly flying to other places to do these, you know, week-long courses. And then over a certain amount of time that people complete, pastors complete their entire curriculum. And, you know, I think of it in terms of good, better, and best.
Yeah.
So if you have nothing, or if you're in like a closed country where you can't have a meeting for pastors, but you can, you know, use a VPN or something to access online content, that's better than nothing.
Yeah.
But we all know that online education is not the same as education in the classroom.
Yeah.
As much as people have worked to try to improve it, it just isn't the same. And
I think after the last 2 years of kids being online, everybody understands that a little better.
Yeah. Yeah. And even when I was doing my PhD, I worked as an online teaching assistant and oversaw Dr. Schreiner's online classes. And you just see they're not getting the same experience. I'm trying my best to interact with them and make it, you know, a back and forth, but they're still not getting the same experience that I was getting when I was sitting in a classroom and there was conversations and there were times between the classes where you're just talking to professors and other students.
Yeah. Like,
you know, there you can't replicate that apart from being in the body. And that's the same thing with even the modular style where somebody is flying in from the outside. And we use that. We have pastors who come and teach, but it's a supplement to what we do. It's not the main thing that we do.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a difference. There's a huge difference from someone teaching a course who lives in this culture and someone teaching a course who has just flown in and may have tried to study the culture as best they could, but you know, you just can't know what you don't know.
Right.
So those are, I'm not denigrating those organizations and stuff, but I'm just saying those methods of training pastors are always going to be second rate to someone actually living and interacting and doing life with the pastors.
Yeah. Which that kind of incarnational ministry is something that we have always, we've talked about several times on the podcast, is really central to what we do here and how we see missions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I personally, I try not to use the word incarnational.
Oh.
Just because I think that's very special to what Jesus did.
Oh.
Okay. In becoming from God to man.
Right.
But not to take away from the point that you're making is that when you live among people, that gives you tools and abilities and wisdom that, so your point remains the same. I just, I don't like using that word to define it. But yeah, so, we, we live here. We have, not only do we live here, but we have a relationship with all the pastors and the students that we're training. So Gospel Life Baptist Mission in Malawi is a partnership between the mission as an organization that's serving 178 churches. And so we have this back and forth cooperation and accountability. So, you know, if I just fly in and there's a group of pastors, I don't know where those pastors came from, you know?
And you don't know what they're doing the rest of the year.
Yeah. And possibly they're just here because they heard there's going to be free food, or they might get something for free, or maybe somebody's paying them to be there. That happens.
Yeah.
And they may be from all across the board, from Pentecostal to, you know, Presbyterian to, you know, all kinds of pastors, but mainly you get charismatic guys coming to those kind of things, because they're charismatic guys use the ministry to make money.
Yep.
That is their entire modus operandi. That's the way their churches work in third world countries. Mm-hmm. When we talk about charismatics in the US and Assemblies of God, there's a lot of great people. But when we look at what we see on the ground here, we see people who are using ministry to make money.
Yeah.
And so if I don't have a accountability type relationship, then I'm just saying things that are going in one ear and going out the other.
Yeah.
And they're just coming for the food or whatever, and then they're going home, and I haven't affected their lives, except for, you know, maybe
a few.
Maybe 5 out of 100 are really convicted by the Holy Spirit and start changing things. And that's great. And that's what, you know, those organizations, they're going to use those people as their poster people.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we have 100% success rate at all, but you know, if I come in and I fly in and I fly out, then that pastor, he may be committing adultery or he may be having multiple wives, but he's going to show up at my training every time and he's going to look the way I want him to look and hide everything from me.
For sure.
But in our organization, if that's happening, then we find out.
Yeah.
And either the church removes the pastor or we remove the church. So there's an accountability set into what we do.
Yeah.
And it's not perfect, and you can't force someone to change or force someone to preach biblical sermons. But when we see major red flags, we deal with it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think crosses the line between just instructing and discipleship.
Yeah.
There's got to be a level of discipline if it's going to be discipleship. And you see in the English language, the connection there, discipleship and discipline. If there's no discipline, then you're not discipling someone. You're just instructing them, and then they're free to do whatever they want with that information.
Yeah, which is what happens, you know, at most schools in the U.S. even.
Yeah, even, you know, instruction. Even at Bible colleges or seminaries, you have a code of conduct and stuff, and if you do something horrible, you can get kicked out. But at the end of the day, and seminary professors will tell you this, at the end of the day, if you have a Master's of Divinity or a BA from whatever seminary or Bible college, that does not say to a church, this person should be your pastor.
Yeah.
That just means this person went through the program and got all the credits and we graduated them, just like college, you know, does in any other sort of discipline, you know, whether it's accounting or computers or whatever. And of course, we have a model in the U.S. where, and I think this is good to a degree, it is churches that have to put their stamp of approval on those guys who are going through those classes, not just to tell the seminary you should accept them, but also that's what ordination is for too. We yeah. believe that there's character and whatnot. But I think there should be a little bit of a closer relationship between the people doing the education in the churches who are doing ordination, and that I don't want to put my stamp of approval, which is the certificate the guys get at the end, on somebody that I don't approve of being in the ministry.
Right.
Because churches, even though we say, oh, churches should know the difference, a lot of churches don't know the difference.
No.
And if you show up with this piece of paper, then they think, well, this guy is good to go.
Yeah.
And he may not be good to go. And so I don't want to give that stamp of approval to people that I don't approve of being in the ministry. And so that's why I think our model, obviously I'm doing it, so I think it's the best. And, you know, we're constantly thinking about how to be better, but I think the model of being in people's lives and living among them and knowing what's going on in the culture is the best way to train pastors. And there is really no good substitute for it. There are things that we can do if we can't do that, but if we can, why are we wasting our time with other things? For today's cultural tidbit, I thought I would ask you about an important part of being a woman in Malawi. Mm-hmm. And that is what in English we would call a wrap.
Yeah.
And
the chitinji.
The chitinji in Chichewa. So explain what it is and how women use it, why it's so important.
Yeah. Women in a lot of African countries wear this. It goes by different names in different languages. But it's just, it's a 2-meter piece of cloth. Usually.
So it's always 2 meters.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they can have them hemmed up where they're a little shorter, especially yeah. like mine that haven't been hemmed are really too long and I have trouble walking in them.
Okay.
But you buy them in 2 meters.
Okay.
They're, you know, you probably imagine them if you've seen pictures. They're usually bright and colorful, have fun patterns on them. They're beautiful and I love them. And women use them for everything.
Yeah.
Here. Mostly they tie them around their waist and they're worn almost like an apron. You know, it's to keep their clothes clean if they have to sit down on something dirty or to wipe their hands on or whatever. They wipe their kids' noses on them. They mm-hmm. you know, you can do pretty much anything with a chitinji. If it's raining, you put on a second one and that kind of helps keep your clothes dry. And then you can mm-hmm. take off that outer one when you get where you're going.
It can be a blanket. It can be a towel.
It can be a towel. Yeah. It can be a blanket that you put out to sit on. It can be like a baby blanket. They wrap mm-hmm. their babies in them. It's a baby carrier. They use them to carry the babies, tie them onto their backs. What else? It can be kind of like a shawl when it's chilly.
Yeah.
They're just an incredibly multi-purpose piece of cloth. And, you know, and so I asked my friend Eunice here one time when we first moved here, you know, why do you wear the chitinji and why do you wear it some days and some days you don't, you know, trying to just understand. And she just said, it's my culture. And it's beautiful, you know, yeah. And so part of it, it's very functional, but it's also just culture to express yourself in that way. With whatever beautiful piece of fabric that you choose to wear that day.
And it can be like, it can be a part of political campaigns.
Yeah.
So like you see people wearing their party's colors and emblems or the face of the candidate. And it can be like special events, especially in churches. They'll have special runs of printed chatinji for that event. Like you went to a women's prayer thing.
Yeah. And we all got matching ones.
Yeah.
Choirs, women's choirs and churches, and things, they'll all get matching ones so they look the same.
Yeah. So it's a very important part of the culture, and it's a beautiful part of the culture. It's part of what makes living here so colorful.
It is. It's wonderful. And it's neat. You see, you know, among my expat friends, you know, foreigners who like us who aren't from here, a lot of us have adopted the chatinji for different things. We'll take them to sit on or to use as a towel if the kids want to play in the creek.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Or like, you know, we're more modest here, so you might be wearing shorts around the house, but if you need to go out, you can just wrap one over your shorts and go do what you need to do.
Yeah, I would never leave the house in shorts, but if I'm hanging out at home and somebody knocks on the gate or I need to run up to the school or whatever, yeah, I just throw a chatinji on.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wear them out in the villages, like for clinics or visiting churches or stuff too, just because it's nice to have the extra layer. All right, you talked a lot in the first part of the podcast about the way that you think teaching should be done. What are specific things that your programs teach?
Yeah, so we have two programs, and I'll go into that in a little bit. We have a modular program for those who are already pastors serving across southern Malawi, and we have a residential program for young men who can come for longer periods of time. In both programs, we have classes split into three categories. We have core classes, which are Bible and theology. So they go all through every book of the Bible, learning, you know, the background to each book and how the Bible fits together as a big story and basic understanding of each book of the Bible. And then they have theology, which would be, you know, the different doctrines we believe, the doctrine of Scripture, the doctrine of God, the doctrine of sin and Jesus and salvation and end times and all of that. That's the core, or you might say the backbone or the foundation of what we do. And then we have what I call secondary classes. And secondary classes are mostly focused on skills that they need. So how to study the Bible, preaching, pastoral ministry, counseling, church planting and evangelism and discipleship. You know, these are things that they have to put the Bible and theology into practice. And so we focus on those things to develop their skills. And then we have a group of what we call short classes. And so we don't take as much time for these classes. They're about half the amount of time in the program as the core or the secondary classes. But there are things that we think it would be helpful for pastors to know in order to understand the Bible well or do ministry well in this environment. So like we have one is ancient world history. So we cover the different civilizations that are mentioned in the Bible so that they have a more historical background because they probably didn't get that covered very well in school. We have like cults and a class on Islam and what else? Family, the biblical family. So we have a lot of different classes that are just kind of briefer topics. And so those three components go together, hopefully to give them the information they need. And then we pair that with actual discipleship and actual ministry experience so that we get the more well-rounded. It's not just instruction, it's discipleship.
So just about the classes and the topics that you teach.
Yeah.
So when you went to Bible school, you obviously learned a lot. But
I hate it when people say Bible school because it sounds like I went to vacation Bible school.
When you went to Bible college, you obviously learned a lot, but you also had a little bit of foundation in most of those subjects already. You know, you knew a little bit about them.
Yeah.
Where are these guys coming from?
So you're right. I grew up in a church where we had great biblical preaching, and even, you know, most of our Sunday school teachers could have been pastors. So they, you know, I knew a lot about the Bible and theology, and I was also a reader too. So I was reading R.C. Sproul and stuff while I was in high school. So a lot of times I'll tell people that when I went to Boyce College, I didn't learn anything at Boyce College, which I'm just exaggerating. Of course, I learned a ton and loved my time there. But what I mean is I didn't learn anything new. Like, I had peers who were coming in from very poor church experiences, and everything was just like opening up new worlds to them.
Yeah.
For me, it was more just like confirming the things I already knew and expanding those things.
Yeah.
So you know, that's where I came from. These pastors are coming from knowing almost nothing. Some of them can't read. That's an older generation that I don't think will last forever. But even those who can read very minimally. They haven't had good teaching. They probably have a lot of bad teaching that they have taken in from other churches or from radio or television, prosperity, charismatic stuff. And so
some of them are probably pretty new believers too, if they're leading new churches.
Some of them with church plants, you know, you have guys who are just young believers themselves, leading that church at the initial stage. And so, and that's exactly why I wanted to do what I do here, because I wanted to be a part of helping guys who knew they had an incredible need. And these guys know that they don't know. And that gives them a hunger to learn that you might not have in situations where everybody thinks they already know everything. So that's where we start at. We start at very basic, zero level.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that we teach that we assume people have the background to understand. And, you know, for one thing, when we're translating things into Chichewa, Chichewa just doesn't have a theological vocabulary. So you can't say substitutionary atonement.
Yeah.
You have to explain it if you're going to translate it. So, you know, what I do is I don't use terminology. Mm-hmm. I just explain the concepts, unless there's like a term that like there is no other option that has to be used and explained. But if I can just explain it without using a term, that makes it clear to them. It makes it easy to translate, and it helps them understand it without being kind of intimidated by jargon.
Yeah. And you have two different ways that you're training pastors, right? Two different parts of the school.
Yeah. So the modular program is what we started with. We have those 178 churches, and all of their pastors are in our modular program. And we have a 5-year teaching rotation on our classes, and they come either to our Zomba campus or our Lower Sheary campus 3 weeks out of the year, 3 separate weeks. Usually right now we're doing February, May, and August. So they come for a week in each month and take a class. And over a course of 5 years, they'll complete the entire program and get a certificate. And we would have finished or been close to finishing already, but because of COVID, our program's behind. But this is like the very basic level of what we can do for guys who are already on the field and can't relocate.
So what's your plan for when they finish and get the 5-year certificate?
Yeah, so that's kind of something that Isaac and I are still discussing. On the one hand, you hate to keep going over things, the same things with them. But on the other hand, that's good to have the repetition.
Yeah. And if they heard it 5 years ago, they might not even remember it.
Yeah. And there's always new pastors that are coming in.
Yeah.
Because we've started new churches, or, you know, the old pastor died and there's a new pastor. So I think the main thing we're going to be doing is just going over the program again and again and again. Now, if we get to the point where there are some guys that's getting old for them, maybe we'll develop something else to go deeper with them. And it is our goal to expand beyond the two programs we're doing now and to take some of the best and the brightest and go deeper with them. And we're talking with schools in the U.S. about doing online hybrid type programs for some of them to get bachelor's degrees. We'll just see what happens. But
because you have a PhD and you can teach bachelor's level classes, right?
I can teach any level of classes.
Any level of classes, because yeah. You're a big nerd.
Yep.
I just had to throw that in. I'm always proud of my big nerd.
Yeah. So we have that program. We have the residential program. And the residential program, some of the guys are already pastors, and we always give the opportunity to the guys who are performing the best on their exams in the residential program, in the modular program, to cross over to the residential. But most of the guys are younger men who feel called to the ministry, and we have an application process and interviews and reading tests and all kinds of things to narrow down who gets to come. But our hope is that these guys are going to be the next generation of pastors and leadership in our mission. And because they're coming for 3 months out of the year, not consecutively, but it's a total of 3 months out of the year, and they do it for 2 years before they graduate. Because they're here long term, we're able to go deeper with them, not just in the courses that we teach, but also in terms of discipleship. And even in January, we hired one of our graduates from our first graduating class to be the director of student discipleship. So Patrick now, he works with the students. Our classes are before lunch, and then in the afternoon, in the evening, he works with the students, facilitates their small group times, which are kind of like accountability times, oversees their scripture memorization, their Bible reading, and deals with different counseling issues, so that we're really hopefully not just remaining on the surface, but we're going deep with these students.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. And it's really cool to have one of our graduates in that position, and seeing, you know, that kind of start, just the start of like a generational effect of what, you know, our training is accomplishing.
Yeah. And he just seems like such a solid guy.
Yeah, he is. And he's really proven himself. And, you know, for our furlough, he's going to be our poster child. Like, literally, we're going to have a banner with his face on it. And an article in the magazine we're producing about kind of his testimony. And He's not the only one, though. You know, I have other graduates that, you know, aren't in that type of position, but, you know, we're roping them into the things we're doing, or they've, you know, become pastors, or, you know, they're, it's great to see that first graduating class of 17 guys and the things that's already happening. And it's less than a year ago we graduated them, and they're already getting plugged into either their church or what the mission's doing.
Yeah. And speaking of graduating, there's one other part of what the residential guys have to do before they graduate.
Yeah. So they have to have ministry experiences. And while they're here on campus, that means that during each week, they're going out into our community, going door to door here in Zomba, having gospel conversations with people, or working in our with our youth at Gospel Life Baptist Church. They are immediately practicing sharing the gospel, because one of the core ideas behind our program is that every pastor, and this kind of goes back to that first question you asked me, what are we producing? Every pastor is also a church planter. Hmm. We don't really believe in our mission context in a division between church planter and pastor. And some guys are obviously going to be more gifted in one or the other. That's inevitable. But we believe every church should be involved in planting other churches. And that starts with the leadership. And so pastors need to know how to share the gospel, different methods of sharing the gospel, how to start churches, how to take a group of people who've believed and disciple them in the first levels of discipleship and bring them into a fully formed functioning church. You know, that's part of the basis of everything we're doing when we're teaching. And so our ministry experiences are meant to prepare them especially for that evangelism and church planting side of things. And so while they're on campus, they're having that directly supervised experiences. We're discussing those things in small groups. I just taught this past term evangelism. So the guys did evangelism, and then we'd come in, they'd tell testimonies, and they wrote reports, and we'd talk about, you know, what they could have done differently and that kind of thing. And then in between academic years, so at the end of their first year, they serve on our what we call day camp teams. So each district of the mission, there's 9 districts with 9 district coordinators who coordinate evangelism, and almost like a DOM, a director of missions in an association in the U.S. So they each 9 of them have a team of 4 young men, and they go out to the churches in their region and do youth camps just for the day, not overnight, where they're doing skits and music and evangelism. They do it at their churches to develop the youth in the churches, but also then they'll go to neighboring villages where there isn't a church, and they'll use it to start churches. So after the first academic year, our students are required to participate in their coordinator's team. And then after their second academic year, we do church planting teams, which is one of most amazing things that God kind of inspired me to do here. And so I was just, you know, thinking about how are we going to teach these guys, you know, how are we going to develop them and train them? And I was just reading through the Gospel of Luke, and I came to Luke chapter 10, where Jesus sends out the 72. And he sends them out 2 by 2, and he tells them to go to village and not take anything with them, trust in the Lord to provide for their needs, and to preach the gospel. And I thought, what is keeping us from doing exactly this in Malawi today? And the answer was nothing is keeping us from just taking exactly what Jesus tells them to do in Luke 10 and just doing it here. And I was thinking about the implications, you know, why does Jesus tell them not to take anything with them? Because I remember when I was a missions minor at Boyce, having a class where we were studying this passage, and one of the issues that came up was in the book of Acts, this same kind of requirement isn't enforced. Like they are taking things with them. Peter says he takes a believing wife with, or Paul says Peter takes a believing wife with him. You know, they're not required to go with nothing, like Jesus says in Luke 10. So why does Jesus say it in Luke 10, but then it's not continued in the book of Acts? And what I remembered from our discussions in classes was that that was because of the transition in salvation history between the Gospels and Acts. But what I come to believe personally is that it was a training method that Jesus was using. What better way to teach these guys that this is the mission of God and that he's going to provide for their needs than forcing them into a situation where they're going to have a short period of time where they're going to experience God providing for their needs.
Yeah.
And so when I think of ministry that in Malawi, so much of it is focused on money.
Yeah.
Like pastors become pastors because they think they can make money. They want to join missions because they think the mission is going to give them handouts. Like it is completely focused on using the church to make a living. And of course, there's nothing wrong with pastors being paid. The Bible says that the laborer is worthy of his pay. But when that becomes your motivation, that becomes wrong.
Right.
You as a pastor, you must not be a lover of money.
Right.
And you must be serving God instead of money. And so, you know, how are we going to teach these guys the right mentality for ministry? Well, let's just use Jesus's model. And so we called it church planting teams. We divide the guys into twos or threes. And we give them bicycles to get where they need to go. We give them Bibles and gospel tracts. And then they go out to an area where we don't have a lot of churches. We might have one or two, or we might have none in this area. And they have a supervisor that takes them there, may introduce them to one or two people, and then the supervisor leaves them. And they've got to trust God for their food. They've got to trust God for a place to sleep. And they're going from village to village, preaching the gospel, seeing people saved, and starting the process of planting churches. They do that for 2 weeks. And that's the very last thing they do before they graduate. And hopefully, it not just gives them experience, but it actually reinforces the things we're teaching in the classroom all the time.
And those guys work. Terrified before they went out last year.
The first group last year was really afraid and wondering, you know, what's going to happen to us? And you know, how are we going to eat? And I kept telling them, look, this is what Jesus did. This is what we're doing. this group, I asked them if they were afraid and they said no. I think part of the reason they're not as afraid because the first group went out and did
survived.
It. And so they can see that there's a track record here.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So we're excited. That will be the first 2 weeks of June, and then there'll be graduation. And then we go on our furlough.
Like a few days later.
Yeah. So this year we have 7 candidates for graduation. They're split up into 3 teams. And they're going to 3 different areas, obviously, 3 teams, 3 areas. So we're already praying. We've been praying this year for those 3 areas, which are Chiredzulu, District, Cholo District, and Mangochi District. So we have teams going into each of those three districts of Malawi. So,
and Mangochi specifically is primarily Muslim.
Mangochi right? is primarily Muslim. It's like the Muslim heartland of Malawi. And so it's a very difficult place. We planted a church there last year, and that church has faced a lot of difficulties. And that team that planted that church, they went in villages and they were chased out by the Muslim leaders. Chiradzulu District is just an area that we have a lot of churches kind of around it, but we don't have churches in it. And it tends to be very rural and in a way a little backwards. Cholo District is renowned. Cholo and Malanji districts are renowned for witchcraft.
Yeah.
And like people from all over Malawi go to those areas to be trained in witchcraft.
Wow.
And then also just right across the border in Mozambique, that's just like, you can see it. Sometimes just notice it when we're out in clinics. When you see one of these guys that have a white sheet painted, you know, with snakes and stuff, that's advertising that they're a doctor, a witch doctor. A lot of times they'll put on that sign that they were trained in Malanji or Cholo.
Wow.
And that's their way of saying, hey, I know what I'm doing. So, so that's a difficult area as well in another way. Yeah. So, you know, be praying for these guys and for our past graduates and for our future graduates. And we really believe that these pastors and these students, they're going to be the ones who go out and reach the unreached people groups. They're going to be the ones that go out and reach Muslims and reach people devoted to African traditional religion. And they can do it much more effectively than what we can do. And so our mission is designed to have this kind of relationship between pastor training, church planting, and compassion ministries so that they're all working kind of as components to help one another operate. All right, everyone's favorite segment, Whatcha Readin'. We didn't do Whatcha Readin' last time. Actually, we did, but I forgot to press record, and so we didn't do it.
Have you pressed record this time?
It is recording, so you can tell the entire world Whatcha Readin'.
Well, this one's a little bit different. We read books with the kids at bedtime each mm-hmm. night, and right now with the boys, I'm reading Five Children and It by E. Nesbitt. And I remembered reading this book as a kid and loving it, but I didn't actually remember anything that was in the book.
Yeah.
Just that I had loved it. So I found it and been reading it to the kids, and it is just so fun. It's so imaginative and sweet, and we're really enjoying it. We're almost to the end, and it's a great read aloud book with your kids.
All right. Well, I am reading on Kindle a book called Same Words, Different Worlds. And the subtitle is Do Roman Catholics and Evangelicals Believe the Same Gospel by Leonardo de Chirico? It's an Italian name. This book was recommended by a friend of ours who's a missionary in Italy, Reed Carr. And we were actually in a birthing class with Reed and Kyra back in 2008.
Yep.
When Jude was within you about to come out. Reed is a missionary in Italy. And I think this is actually written by the pastor, the Italian pastor that he works with in Rome. And so, you know, we have a lot of Catholics in Malawi, and I just thought it would be, you know, a good thing to kind of brush up. And this is a really good book that, as the title points out, there's a lot of common words that we use. You know, we both talk about grace. We both talk about faith. We both talk about gospel between Catholicism and evangelicalism. But when we talk about those things, we're not talking about the same thing. And so this is a short read. And if you are working in any sort of Catholic environment or you have Catholic family or friends, I highly recommend Same Words, Different Worlds.
Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Gospel Life Go.
God provides for the needs of Gospel Life through your prayers and gifts. To become a prayer or giving partner, go to gospellife.org.
We hope you join us in glorifying God by growing disciples who make disciples. We hope that you live a gospel life.